Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
The Dan Bernstein Show. Weekdays 9 a.m. to noon on Sports Radio 670 The Score.
The pitch to Machado, 1-2. Swing and a miss, strike three. Lester strikes him out to end the inning.
Ah, the sounds of baseball, the sounds of fans. We may have one, but not the other, or neither, depending on what happens today in the exchange of proposals and later on in the week. This is a critical week for baseball. I think this is a big week for sports, that we'll remember this as the make or break time, when either they were able to figure it out in these three leagues or they were not. And talking about the potential return of baseball was John Lester over the weekend. He was on The Score with Bruce Levine and Matt Spiegel. And the Cubs left-hander was first and foremost asked how he and his family have been doing.
Physically, everything's good. Family's good. Laying low and all that stuff. I mean, I'm sure I'm with everybody else on the mental side of it, where it's, it gets a little old just kind of sitting around not doing anything. So, hopefully we can kind of get some life back into everybody and get back going, doing what we're used to doing.
Do you do any active farming, John? You doing any work on your farm these days, as you've had all this time on your hands?
I haven't done anything at the farm, no. I just went down there yesterday, took the boys down there fishing and kind of putted around down there. But we got a little garden in the backyard I've been messing around with and doing that. But no, nothing down on the farm. I got the people that know what the heck they're doing that and taking care of that for me.
John, as fans of the games, first and foremost, we're all fans, whether you play or you broadcast or you watch it. We love the game. What should fans, you being a veteran of so many years and negotiations that you've seen between players and owners, what should we as fans pay attention to when we hear posturing going on both sides and the intricacies of being able to return to a normal half season of baseball?
Well, I think the biggest thing, and I mean, I'm guilty of it just like everybody else, is you can't believe everything that's put out there. A couple of weeks ago, we had stuff being leaked that wasn't even presented to the players yet. So there's just a lot of stuff. I think people have a lot of time, obviously, on their hands to, I don't want to say fabricate stories, but, really try to dig and find things, possible leaks and so forth. So I think the biggest thing is you can't believe every little word that's written about either side. I think either side right now has been great. We're really trying to work towards an agreement to get this thing going. I think everybody's main concern is the safety. The other stuff we can kind of figure out as we go, but players and owners and all this stuff, doctors, everybody wants to be safe. So we don't want to rush into this thing and start risking health. So not only health based on this pandemic, but health physically for the player when it comes to shortened spring training and trying to get revved up for a season that fast. So I think that's the main thing that players are focusing on, owners are focusing on, is the health And then, you know, obviously the other stuff will fall when we can kind of figure out the testing and so forth.
Hey, John, the 67-page document with all the safety protocols and how baseball might do the testing and how it might look, it was daunting, and it seemed extremely thorough. Wondering how that was received from your perspective, if you thought MLB was looking out for your safety as it went through that, and you personally as a cancer survivor, how you're feeling about you know, the level of safety that the game will be able to provide to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody's, like I said, everybody's main concern is safety. And anytime you get a group of people in a room or on a phone call or on a Zoom call or whatever it may be, you're going to have a million different opinions and a million different questions. So when that was laid in front of us, and then you hear all the information, you're immediately going to have questions. And sometimes you have the same question as another guy, you just word it differently. So it takes a while to get through this stuff. It's not just going to happen overnight. But like I said, MLB, from the owner side of it to the player side of it, we're bending over backwards to try to get this health side of it figured out. You know, that we have our own testing facility. So we're not taking anything away from the public as far as that. So I think there's a lot of positives in it. It's just, like I said, you get all these players and all these owners on phone calls and stuff like that. You're going to have a million different questions that people have to or want to get answered in order to move forward.
That's the voice of John Lester. This is Inside the Clubhouse with Matt Spiegel and Bruce Levine. We're here for you every week, 52 weeks out of the year, talking baseball from 9 to 11. John, what are the personal challenges of John Lester after going through one spring training and now the reality of another for 3 weeks, getting back to baseball at your age and your experience without having left some things behind in the first spring training and moving forward to the unknown of an 82-game season?
I think the biggest challenge is just the unknown. You know, we've had some phone calls with, you know, with Rossi and other players and, you know, our pitching coach, Tommy. You know, and that's really everybody's concern. But for me especially, I just don't want to get ramped up for an unknown date and, you know, kind of have to turn it back down. So it's a fine line of keeping the arm moving, playing some catch, doing some things, you know, not necessarily, you know, maybe getting off the mound right this second. But I think you just, once we get this date, then you can kind of, you know, I've been doing enough stuff to be able to build. And I feel like you're just kind of, you know, mentally waiting for that date. And once that date hits, it's like, okay, now I go. So that's been kind of the challenge, is just is balancing the unknown of, you know, every year you work towards February 14th or February 18th or whatever it is for spring training. So you have that date, that end date in mind, you know, when you're working out in November or December and you're throwing in January, like, okay, I'm building towards this date. You know, right now there's no date to build towards. So it's kind of, you know, that unknown is kind of throwing you off mentally. It's like you can't really get after it. You can't really prepare like you would for normal spring training. You know, that being said, when you get there, whatever that date may be, you know, I know, you know, our medical staff, our coaching staff, we're all going to be erring on the side of caution to get guys ramped up. So, you know, we definitely don't want to be coming in first day and throwing an inning or two innings or whatever to hitters and now you're pushing yourself back where you possibly can't even play 81 games or 82 games. So there's just that fine line, and I think, like I said, the biggest thing is just the unknown.
John, it's been so crazy to realize how unique and individual everybody's situation is in terms of what they can do to be ready. You know, we've talked to some pitchers who have a net in the backyard, and some pitchers have a mound in the backyard, and some guys don't. You know, what's your setup at home? Do you have enough stuff to do anything you want to do? Do you have somebody who could catch you if you wanted to throw off the mound at full strength at some point?
Yeah, I got enough stuff downstairs in my house to take care of what I need to take care of and stay where I need to stay as far as strength-wise, you know, going into a spring training. So I've got that, you know, that benefit. And I do have a kid that I've thrown to probably the last, well, since I moved up to Atlanta, 5 years or so. And he actually just took a job with last year with the Dodgers as a bullpen catcher. So I got a catcher I can throw to and throw off the mound. And there's a local high school up here that we go and play catch in the football field and baseball field. So, you know, it's nice being down in Atlanta and having the weather and having the opportunity to get outside and still, you know, be safe, but also get your work done.
John, how can baseball better market baseball players? Now, I've been, you know, I worry about the sport. I worry about, you know, the fact that other sports continue to market their players in a better fashion. I've heard from people in ownership and front offices saying that the arbitration system works against baseball because of the fact that that can be used if a player is marketed to a high level on certain teams. What are some of your thoughts about how baseball can better sell itself during games themselves and in general to make the players more interesting and also more more present in people's lives?
You know, Bruce, I don't know. You know, I think that's really an individual thing. You know, I know it took me a long time to kind of let my guard down and let some people in and do some different interviews and do some different things, allow people to come to the farm. You know, 7-8 years ago, I probably wouldn't have done that. So I think it's an individual thing. I think now, too, there's so much social media, there's so much of your own branding that, you know, guys are kind of doing it on their own. They don't need a baseball team to do that. They don't need the Chicago Cubs to do that for them. You know, and just like any other sport, you know, you have the stars, you have the guys that draw the attention of the camera for whatever reason, whether they be, you know, the better players of the team or just a more personality type player, you know, whatever that may be. Like I said, I think it's an individual thing. I think anytime a team tries to do something, it comes across to the players as kind of forced, uncomfortable. You know, I think if you allow the player to be themselves and to kind of have their own ideas and then the team go along with them, I think you're going to get, you know, more of that, of what that player or that individual is actually like. You know, I know they've started miking guys up during spring training games. You know, that's a perfect time to do it because it is a little more relaxed. During a regular season, I don't think – you know, I know for me on a personal level, if I'm pitching and I got, you know, player A over here on a microphone talking to some analyst during a game, I don't really feel like he's focused in everything he needs to do in a regular season game. You see what I'm saying? Like, so there's like a fine line there of getting that involved. You know, like I said, I think number one is the individual, is the player, the person himself and what he wants to do. To market himself, to brand himself in the game.
I think that's wise. I think that the guys who are willing to share and are expressive should be encouraged, as opposed to trying to drag everybody up to a certain level. That makes a lot of sense. What the game can control is maybe a rule here or there to make the game more interesting. I miss action, John. I don't know about you, but I miss balls in play, as opposed to home runs or strikeouts. And do you think the game would be served by trying to find a way to tweak a couple of things to to give us more action, more fielders moving around, more runners running around the bases?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think they kind of tried that with the new baseball that they won't admit that they put in play. And then that produced more home runs. So, you know, now you've got, I think their intentions were to do that, were to allow more balls in play, but then that turned into a driving range, basically. They're out there, you know, guys are out there hitting title as Pro B1s as opposed to, you know, right. I think a more fair ball. I think if you want more action, then, yeah, you can go somewhere in between where we've been, you know, the playoff ball of this year and then the regular season ball. You know, I think right now in our era and what we're teaching, you're not going to result in more balls in play. You know, you are in the aspect of power, you know. You're going to result in more doubles, more home runs, stuff like that. But as far as choking up and putting the ball in play, you know, Bruce, you were talking about the arbitration process. These guys that get called up know what's getting them paid in arbitration, and it's not singles to the opposite field.
Right.
It's slug, it's OPS, it's home runs, it's, you know, it's all this stuff. So you've created, through this, you've created your own problem, basically, in baseball. Is guys started getting paid for these numbers, and now you're reaping, or you're seeing the negative side of it. Guys are stronger, they're throwing faster. You know, you're preaching more spin rate. You're preaching, you know, you're not worried about location. You're just throwing the ball as hard as you can and spinning it as hard as you can. So that's a perfect storm for, okay, if I make a mistake and a guy clips me, it's a homer. If I don't, I just throw hard enough to where he swings and misses, and now I've got strikeouts, walks, home runs. You know, that's the game we're in right now. I think everything will loop back around. You know, I think owners are always looking for ways to cut costs, and, you know, they'll find a new metric that means more to them than OPS, and that'll change the player into something else. You know, the players are always evolving. The owners are always evolving. So, like I said, I think the game is a big ebbs and flows game, and I think right now we're in one of these fast of the game, and I think everything will kind of loop back around, hopefully, next couple years.
John, Matt and I really appreciate you joining us today, and all the best to you and your family. We hope we see you soon. My last question to you is this. When the first player does indeed test positive, how do you think that will follow with the rest of the group, and do you concern yourself with your conversations with teammates and other people in the game as to how the reaction to that will occur and how baseball will handle that?
You know, I think that's kind of a lot of the conversations we're having right now. You know, that's that trust factor in our medical staff. You know, I can speak for the Cubs. We've got a great medical staff that bends over backwards for us and does amazing work. And so if we are getting back and we are playing, you know, we need to have this open line of communication and talking to where if something like this does happen, you know, we need to be informed. I think that's really the big thing for players is we want information as well. You know, you can't just tell us to come back and play and expect us to just to turn our heads and go, okay, yeah, we'll play with this risk. So as long as we have the information and the doctors have a plan for something like this to happen, that makes everybody feel more comfortable. And then, you know, if it does, then we have this protocol in place to where, you know, whatever that may be, quarantine, more testing, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's a long list of things that we can possibly do. But like I said, that's a huge topic of conversation right now with both sides is trying to figure out the steps of which that, you know, kind of how to handle this thing going forward. Everybody's ultimate goal, obviously, is to get back into play. And that's not only for the players and the owners, but for the fans, more importantly, and for the country. I think we all need to take our minds off of what's going on and get back to playing and having sports and trying to get a little bit back to normalcy if we can. So we're all striving to get there, and hopefully we can do that soon. But, you know, just know that it's a process right now, and it may take a minute, but we're trying to get there.
We're all for normalcy. John Lester, that was terrific stuff. It's rare to hear him with his guard down quite like that, to hear him that personable without doing his whole bit, without doing his whole tough guy thing, just to hear him being real and being the way he is around and teammates and the way they always talk about him. That's him as open as I've ever heard him in any format ever. It was that's just a tremendous interview, and you're hearing a lot from a guy who is, you know, he's too old to care right now. You know, you hear him talking about the guys paid to slug and spin rate and what they're getting paid for, and there's wistfulness in there that I hear. You know, this is an old cowboy who knows where he is in his career, who struggled at times last year with his velocity, doesn't have the margin for error with where he's placing some of these pitches, with the command and control that has to be perfect, the pitch selection that has to be just right because he's not throwing it up there 94 miles an hour anymore. So he doesn't know where he is, and it's got to be hard to be in the twilight of a great career, a borderline Hall of Fame career, probably not there yet. And this hurts him because this was a guy who needed to start amassing counting stats in an effort to burnish his Hall of Fame credentials. So he's certainly missing out on that opportunity. I want to find out what you heard, what you think, what mattered to you in that as a Cub fan. 312-644-6767. I'm Dan Bernstein. I should mention that usually in our 1140 segment, we talk to a teammate, we have some fun with something. We're doing something a little different today because I screwed up. I missed a birthday on Friday. And I was thinking, oh, God, we got to do something on that. And it's not too late, and we're going to, because somebody very important to us, especially if you're of a certain age, somebody very important to us turned 40 on Friday. So we are going to speak to a writer who wrote all about this particular birthday. And it's something that I really hadn't thought of. And I remember the first time I had, first time I met this guy who just turned 40, and remembering where it was and when it was. We're going to get to that, but I also want to know what you thought about what John Lester had to say about safety, about wanting to come back, about making sure that the players do have their doubts as set aside as they possibly can, let alone try to figure out all of what's happening with the money. 312-644-6767. I'm Dan Bernstein. 9 to noon, Monday through Friday, right here, live and local on The Score.
Had some phone calls with, you know, with Rossi and other players and you know, our pitching coach, Tommy. That's really everybody's concern. But for me especially, I just don't want to get ramped up for an unknown date and, you know, kind of have to turn it back down. So it's a fine line of keeping the arm moving, playing some catch, doing some things. Not necessarily, you know, maybe getting off the mound right this second. But I think you just, once we get this date, then you can kind of, you know, I've been doing enough stuff to be able to build. And I feel like you're just kind of, you know, mentally waiting for that date. And once that date hits, it's like, okay, now I go.
That's Cubs starting pitcher John Lester, who was on this weekend on Inside the Clubhouse with Bruce Levine and Matt Spiegel. And think about it, when you're not just a starting pitcher, but a veteran, the idea of multiple dry firing and what that does to you, there aren't a lot of athletes like a pitcher that, at least what used to be what a starting pitcher was, and who has any idea now, if and when baseball comes back, what it's going to mean to be a starting pitcher. If you're talking about somebody like Michael Kopech, who left one world and returns in another world, and we start talking about for whether it's going to be some maybe seven-inning doubleheaders that are going to change the bullpen. And just last week, we were talking to Matthew Trueblood about it, and he said that there's going to be all kinds of bullpenning going on, that a lot of this may just accelerate some trends that we already saw in effect, with teams being really flexible about how they define the roles of their pitchers, but that's hard on a 35, 36-year-old arm. Is that what he is, 36, 37 maybe? That when you're going to be asking him to get into game shape and stretch out and be ready to go and then have to shut it down again? Like, he just wants to be sure, if I do this, if I put my body through what it needs to be put through to get where I have to be, that it might not survive another cycle intact of going through the days and the weeks. Then you go through your spring training dead arm period. There's the guys who even build that in, and it really is asking a great deal of a starting pitcher to sort of back time all of these things, and you need to be here for this and here for this and here for this, and your first start might be this. You know how carefully down to the day, it's even the side sessions in between starts, that with those kind of unknowns, you're just asking for injury possibility. And there's other starting pitchers in their 30s on the Cubs who are thinking about some of these things. And in case you missed it earlier, you should hear this, because on Mully and Haw, Gordon Wittenmeyer of the Sun-Times brought up another name talking about reservations about baseball's return plan from a Cubs starting pitcher.
In the case of the Cubs, Yu Darvish was the first one who expressed publicly real concern over this. The minute he showed up to spring training, he went to team officials and said, look, I'm going to be dealing more often with people coming over from Japan who want my time, media, and so on. And what are you doing to protect me from this? This was before, in this country, we had, you know, everything was distant to us, right? And this was a disease in another country. He was following every bit of news coming out of every part of the world on just how serious this thing was, and he was taking it seriously. He bought his way out of some appearances that he had scheduled in January, tens of thousands of dollars paid to get out of these things because they involved people coming over from Asia to be in the same room with him. I don't know what his feelings are on this. I tried to reach him directly. I tried to get an answer through his agent, and nobody would give me an answer. So I don't know where he is on this, but I know he takes it very seriously. And I'm not saying that he would opt out necessarily, but I could see it. And if he did, where does that leave the Cubs competitively?
Right. That would be an unbelievable blow for the Cubs. You know, John Lester has underlying health issues. He was on the station this weekend and sounded like he's getting ready to gear up and just needs a date. But it occurs to you that, wow, I mean, this is a cancer.
Well, yeah, and Anthony Rizzo. And Anthony Rizzo, same thing as Lester. He expresses a desire. He's going to come back. He says doctors have told him he's at no greater risk than anybody else. I saw a story in the LA Times. Dave Roberts, a cancer survivor, said his doctor, I believe the team doctor, told him the same thing, that he's not at any greater risk than he would have been at. Now, that's not what the CD said a while back, but maybe these are, you know, in individual cases, these guys have, rebuilt. I don't know. In the case of, Rizzo, he's 30 years old and Lester's a few years older than that, but you know, they beat back the disease a long time ago. Maybe they've whatever's transpired since has put them in a better place. I don't know. They plan to play, but yeah, it doesn't take much imagination to start going team to team and player to player in some cases and suggesting, this guy or this guy. I mean, it takes one or two key guys on any team to really change the entire calculus of what your competitive season might look like.
That was Gordon Wittenmeyer, the beat writer for the Cubs for the Chicago Sun-Times, on with Mully and Haw this morning on The Score. I want to clarify something, though. When we use the phrase opt out, we're not talking about Darvish literally opting out of his contract as we were discussing in the fall. Because remember, we had to get reassurances from reporters that it started coming in that after Darvish's big second half, that he, with $81 million and 4 years left on his deal, that he wasn't going to literally opt out of the contract. Was this like small o, as in opt out of playing this season if he has concerns? Because those are very different things. I just want to make sure that we're sort of defining the parameters of the discussion here. it might be that he wouldn't want to play, whether it's for health reasons or for family health reasons or public health reasons, who knows what it is, that he would then, given the opportunity, and I think all baseball players will be afforded this opportunity, given the opportunity, he would decide to not play. But someone would be insane, absolutely insane, to actually opt out of $81 million of contractual value right now, heading into what is a massive unknown, where someone like Mookie Betts, we were speculating, what was the estimate that we were hearing here? Was it Evan Drellich who was mentioning it could be $100 million less? The idea of teams having to absorb whatever losses they're going through now from television revenue and everything else in baseball advanced media, that anybody who's got that contract on the books, it's one thing to start talking about pennies on the dollar or working out some sort of agreement to defer for this year just to get back. But my guess is we're talking about opting out of playing this year instead of necessarily opting out of a deal. Somebody's an agent have come running and screaming to his house and say, what are you doing? What are you doing? That is, but if in fact he is taking this very seriously and he's extremely informed and or concerned, that is his absolute right. If he decides he doesn't want to play, and he was tremendous in that second half last year, that's what they were paying for. That's what they were hoping for. And it would be a shame if in whatever is still occurring here in his prime, that they're missing out on this as the clock ticks on his deal. I'm Dan Bernstein, and when we come back, we have special birthday wishes to someone who is important to you, someone who has mattered in your life, turned 40 on Friday, and Michelle Delgado wrote about it for the Smithsonian. You think, what the hell are you talking about, Bernstein? Well, we're going to have some fun with this, with some 40th birthday wishes to a guy you know and love. Michelle Delgado is an expert on it, having written a big piece about this anniversary. She's going to join us next on The Score. Dan Bernstein with you on Sports Radio 670 WSCR, The Score. And as always, around 1140, we like to change things up a little bit, have a little bit of fun, which we are going to do right now with freelance author Michelle Delgado. You may have seen her work in any number of publications, including The Atlantic and The Smithsonian. She's on Twitter at M. Delgadia. And she joins us on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Michelle, how are you?
I'm doing good. Thanks so much for chatting with me today, Dan. How are you?
I'm good. I got such a kick out of this story regarding the 40th birthday of our guy, Pac-Man. And it actually caused me to try to think about when I first saw the game. And I remembered it. And I actually confirmed it. I called a childhood friend of mine. And it was in 1980 at the Axel Roller Rink in Niles. It was some birthday party, like a fifth grade birthday party or fourth grade birthday party. And I had enjoyed video games up to then, Space Invaders and all the original coin ops. But you knew it. As a 10-year-old, I knew something was different when I saw this. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have been able to articulate it, but I would say it was a thing. And all of us at that age knew it was a thing. And I think you, in your piece for Smithsonian, you really captured that energy.
Well, thank you. And this is exactly what I love about Pac-Man. I think everybody has that story of being a kid and wandering into some public place, and you just come across this thing that's completely captivating that you've never seen before. And I think it really cuts across a lot of different generations. It's for people who came up in the 80s. I mean, I'm a child of the 90s, and I remember walking into my tiny little hometown's ice cream parlor, and they had a cocktail table cabinet of Pac-Man, and I was just blown away. I was like, what is this? It was so much fun. And I think it really speaks to the game's uniqueness, its creativity, and its ability just to captivate audiences for all of these years.
One of my favorite details was when you chronicled the history and how the creator actually was eating a pizza, ordered an entire pizza, and while he was eating it, he was inspired by the negative space when the wedge of the New York style slice gets removed, because you know in Chicago the tavern style cutting or the deep dish, you're not going to get the same effect. But they had he saw it. He literally saw the open mouth there, and it's just amazing to me how something this worldwide icon could be so simple, that the inspiration could be that easy, that simple.
Yeah, and I think it really, you know, at the time, Namco, the company behind Pac-Man, was just going out of its way to hire really off-the-wall creative thinkers. You know, they were saying, you know, we're not necessarily looking for straight-A students. We're not looking for you to be the top of your class, the rule follower. They specifically were going into magazines and saying, you know, are you a delinquent? Are you a C student? Can you think outside the box? Like, okay, we want to hire you. And I think it just really speaks to the creator, Toru Iwatani's creativity, just that he could get inspiration in such a mundane setting, like just being hungry and ordering a pizza, and to have that inspire this iconic game. I think just he must have been very open-minded to be just thinking outside the box like that. That little anecdote just blew me away as well when I was doing the research. I love that story.
Now, tell me about how a story like this gets written. Is this, as a freelancer, do you just get inspired and say, oh, Pac-Man's turning 40, I'm going to write it, and then I'm going to find somebody to run it? Or does an editor come to you and say, we'd like you to write this Pac-Man piece?
Yeah, I have a very special relationship with Smithsonian. I actually wrote a newsletter for about 3 years. And so every week, as a little writing challenge to myself, I would pick something completely random, and I would look into the history of it. And so I did diner mugs, I did windshield wipers, and at one point I did Pac-Man. And so last fall, a friend of mine who works at Smithsonian forwarded my newsletter to her editor, Megan Gambino, who's a wonderful editor. And she said, hey, is there anything we can, you know, do with this? Maybe some of these items are in Smithsonian's collections. And I think a lot of people have been to Smithsonian here in Washington, D.C. And, you know, you see the big museum, but what you might not realize is that they have just an absolutely massive amount of collections that they don't display to the public. And so over the past few months, my editor and I have just gone through my newsletter archive and figured out, okay, well, which of these things has the Smithsonian actually collected? And is there room to do a deeper, more reported story here? And so I've just had a lot of fun revisiting some of these topics that I looked into just on a whim over the past few years, and turning them into these reported stories that actually drill into the numbers of, okay, well, you know, how much can we put a dollar value on Pac-Man? Can we figure out exactly how Ms. Pac-Man came along? Looking into all of those questions and digging into that reporting with the support of a great editor at Smithsonian has just been a blast for me. So, yeah, I hope to do more of these.
The Ms. Pac-Man story is wild, and I didn't know any of this. I mean, just as from a business reporting perspective, the idea of these kids that created GCC, the General Computer Corporation, MIT dropouts, who mm-hmm. used a Pac-Man template kit to create something called Crazy Otto, which then they somehow, in like this wild opportunity, just a Hail Mary, sold it back to Bally Midway, and then they, using refurbished or reprogrammed Pac-Man machines, then put out Ms. Pac-Man to rave reviews. I didn't know any of that.
It blew my mind, and it was something that I kept coming across in articles. People would say, you know, other writers in the past were really focused on Pac-Man, and when it came to Ms. Pac-Man, they would say, oh, and actually Ms. Pac-Man is one of the highest-selling games in the world, and, you know, there were some licensing issues, and I just couldn't get a straight answer on exactly what went on there. And so when I called Carly Kokurek, who is a historian at the Illinois Institute of Technology, she's the author of Point Operate Americans. Basically, as I was doing my reporting, everyone said, you have to talk to Carly. She knows all about this. She said, look into Crazy Otto. Like, I think that's going to lead you on to some interesting information here. And I just happened to stumble across this amazing oral history that Fast Company had published talking to those MIT dropouts you mentioned. And yeah, it just absolutely blew my mind. I could not, I just, as a reporter, you stumble across something like that just has all the answers to the questions and the confusion that you have of how did this thing come about? And that did just end up being such an amazing story of these conversion kits that would be used to mod Pac-Man games. And what's so cool about it is that because the way Ms. Pac-Man was set up, to offer Ms. Pac-Man, the companies like, you know, roller skating rinks, Pizza Huts, what have you, they actually had to buy a copy of Pac-Man. So not only was Ms. Pac-Man flying off the shelves, but also it was continuing to drive sales of the original Pac-Man game, which I think goes a long way for explaining how, you know, Pac-Man hit these amazing astronomical sales numbers.
It also had me thinking about other aspects of sort of my video gaming childhood, because I was like just wheelhouse for all this stuff. And it was the weird inconsistencies from game to game and from game cabinet to game cabinet that you would get an arcade that would swap out tech. And it would be a cabinet that just kind of looked weird, or the controls would be reversed. And you would get your – there were some Ms. Pac-Man games that were fast, where you could just move around really, really fast, and others that were slower, just like later in there were Galaga games where you could double the shooting speed, and it was just dumb luck what you got at your laundromat or in the bar. Either you got a fast shooter, a fast Ms. Pac-Man. Is that because of these conversion kits and the automatic inconsistencies in some of that?
I would guess yes. I mean, I didn't look into that specifically, but it would make a lot of sense that if, you know, there were lots of sort of bootleg games circulating at this time, intellectual property for games was really messy in the beginning. People didn't really know, you know, can you trademark a character? Are you going to trademark the gameplay? You know, a lot of games were really similar, so how would that even work? There's just a lot of haziness in the early days of the industry, and so I do think that it would probably be a combination of you know, bootleg stuff floating around, and also just a lot of inconsistency probably in the cabinets. And, you know, it's funny, one of the super fans I interviewed, actually the first time he played Pac-Man was green instead of yellow. And for years he thought that Pac-Man was this green character. And it wasn't until later he realized that, oh no, my Pizza Hut just had a broken screen.
Wow. Yeah, this is, see, I could read thousands of words on this stuff, but I do think there was something important that came out near the end of your story. And that has to do with what Pac-Man did culturally to understand that gamers were of a certain breed. Gamers were a lot of dorky white kids. And eventually Pac-Man broadened the game a little bit and brought it to women, and they learned that there were vastly underserved areas of a video gaming constituency. And interestingly enough, we find ourselves now in an era of video gaming that has found some pretty dark places. And a lot of it is because of the first-person shooter games and because of what we know has happened socioculturally with Gamergate, et cetera. And again, is angry and male and white. And this could be a lesson if in the 40-year birthday of Pac-Man to maybe get a better understanding of how some of these companies can reach out to underserved or marginalized groups that just would love to be a part of video gaming.
Absolutely. And I think we do have cause for hope, too. Last week I attended the NYU Game Center's, one of their graduation activities, where all the people who are graduating with master's degrees in game design were sharing the games that they made over the course of their master's program. And not only was it an incredibly diverse group, but it was also the games that they had made were so beautiful and so incredibly off-the-wall creative. I do hope that, I think that the talent is there. I think there are lots of people who want to make the industry better and serve audiences with a lot of different content. And I think, you know, as long as space can be created and you know, people can get the space they need to create the games they want to, the audience is clearly there. I think if Pac-Man shows us anything, it's that once you start offering different things, the audience will definitely show up and follow it.
Well, it's very cool. So happy birthday to Pac-Man, and it was very, very well chronicled by our guest, Michelle Delgado. Thanks for joining us today, Michelle.
Thanks so much. Have a good rest of your day.
You too. Good health. That is Michelle Delgado. You can find her work at the Smithsonian, the Atlantic, City Lab, Literary Hub, and other national and local outlets. We have some thank yous to send out to everybody involved in our Tuesday show today. I almost called it a Monday show, but I avoided doing that. Thank you to Joe Cowley. Thank you to Michael Russo. And thank you to Michelle Delgado for being a part of things. Jay Zawoski is our executive producer. The executioner, Ray Diaz, has been the man on the board. And I believe I just saw, correct me if I'm wrong, it appears that the NHL is going to make some kind of official statement about their plans to return at some point later this afternoon. So tomorrow we'll obviously have a little more concrete stuff to talk about regarding sports kind of coming back, I guess. So that's really cool. So make sure you are maintaining your social distancing. Make sure you are continuing to wash your hands a lot. Wear a mask if you are indoors and unable to maintain proper social distancing. And listen, to half the people I see, literally half the people I see, if you are not wearing your mask over your nose and mouth, you are not wearing a mask. You are defeating the purpose of it. Nose and mouth. It's not for you. It's for everybody else. And it's not necessarily about you. It's okay to care about other people, believe it or not. Might feel better. Listen to doctors and only listen to people who listen to doctors. Looking forward to another informative and entertaining show tomorrow. Mike Florio is going to join us. We have Keith Smith on the NBA, and Spiegs is going to join us too to check in and talk a whole bunch of things and have some fun. Have a great rest of your day. We'll talk tomorrow. Stay tuned for Lawrence.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.